24-7030, United States v. Hebert. Counsel for appellant, if you would make your appearance and proceed.
And I'm Violet Edelman, and I'm representing Joel Ruiz. It is my intention to be up here for 15 minutes, at which point I will pass things over to counsel for Mr. Hebert.
I will leave that to you, and there's consistent with our rule, you have the first 3 minutes are yours, please.
Thank you. Section 1152's extension of federal jurisdiction into Indian country is and always has been defined by the limitation created by its diversity of status requirement. Because Congress made its exercise of power conditional upon that requirement, diversity of status is a jurisdictional element of any crime charged under Section 1152. In other words, the diversity of status requirement defines the kinds of cases that fall under the scope of 1152. So the rule is jurisdictional in the sense that it sets forth the circumstances under which general criminal law is brought to bear on a case in Indian country. The government offers no model for treating a jurisdictional requirement like this one as an affirmative defense, and there's no way that this court can follow the government's logic without distorting the statutory text, thwarting its purpose and structure, and eschewing the foundational principles of Indian country legislation and jurisprudence, which put respect for tribal sovereignty at the forefront of any question of statutory interpretation related to jurisdiction. And with that, I welcome the court's questions.
Well, I'll start. What is your response to Professor Washburn's approach? You have in a footnote a comment that, well, the General Crimes Act and the Major Crimes Act were adopted 60 years apart, and in the Major Crimes Act, there was no express intention to amend 1152, but why does that have any bearing on the wisdom of Professor Washburn's approach? In other words, if the crime taking place in Indian country and the victim being an Indian are jurisdictional facts, that as you argue that the government has the burden to prove those, then why isn't the fact that it's an Indian on Indian crime under 1153 or a non-Indian on Indian crime under 1152, simply one crime. Much like Judge Higginson said in the Fifth Circuit, the crime is the commission of murder against an Indian on Indian country.
So the first thing I would say to that broad point from the amicus is that this case has always been an 1152 case, and we've always been arguing about 1152. So, and the government has only sort of peripherally invoked 1153. So I'm not sure that argument is at issue in this case, but I think stepping back, academically speaking, 1152 brings in a broad world of conduct, criminal conduct, that is not covered by 1153. So by its plain terms, I don't think it's possible to read 1152 as a matter of statutory construction based on a comparison to 1153 when it would play out differently depending what the crime, what the substantive crime for 1152
well,
is.
Just to play devil's advocate, you argue on page 7 that 1152 doesn't define any crimes. It simply extends a federal enclave jurisdiction to conduct that would otherwise be criminal. So it's not like that you're arguing that there's two separate crimes, one in 1152 and one in 1153, because you've expressly argued to us that 1152 doesn't individually identify any crimes.
That's true. It doesn't. It brings in a world of substantive crimes of the general enclave jurisdiction into Indian country, and then defines how that applies. But the fact is, it does include conduct that is not covered by 1153. And 1153 was very carefully circumscribed to the conduct that is described and to the offenses that are enumerated there. I think the other thing that I would say is that the two kind of my point in the footnote about the history and the difference in the two provisions is that they were passed at different times, arose from different contexts, and addressed different things. And I don't think any court has read them together the way that Professor Washburn is suggesting this court should do. And I think that's because they are two different creatures. And so I don't think there's any precedent or reason why this court should now be construing the terms of 1152 in light of 1153 that way.
Should the opinion say anything about 1153?
I don't think it needs to. I think this is an 1152 case, and we're talking about what that statute says and what it means. And they belong to different, that would be a different case.
Counsel, could I bring you back to your opening statement? You referred to a jurisdictional element. And I'm going to ask you a question that draws a distinction between subject matter jurisdiction on the one hand, which, as I understand it, comes under 18 U.S.C. 3231, and the jurisdictional element, which, if I'm understanding your brief correctly, is tied to Congress's authority to define a crime under the Constitution. Does that align with what your briefing is so far?
Yes.
Okay. Isn't the jurisdictional element requirement in 1152 the requirement that the offense was committed in Indian country, not something based on the party's identities?
No, I don't think that is the extent of the jurisdictional requirement in Indian country. And I think
Can you call it an element? Yes, the element.
I'd like to sort of clarify the premise of my argument is really that this is about what Congress decided to do in 1152. It is connected to questions about what it can do. But it decided to limit these cases to ones that involve diversity of status. And so in that way, it limited the jurisdiction it was exercising. And so I don't think this court needs to reach the question whether Congress could pass a statute that says this is criminal because this is covered by federal jurisdiction because it occurred in Indian country.
But isn't that the common understanding of a statute's jurisdictional element? I mean, I'm thinking of the federal gun statutes that include interstate commerce as an element of proof. It's a jurisdictional element to ensure that application of the gun laws fit within Congress's Commerce Clause authority. It seems to me that if you're arguing that Indian status is a jurisdictional element, that's because we need to ensure that the application of the statute falls within Congress's authority to adopt this statute. And if that's the case, then I don't see how it's a jurisdictional element when the United States Supreme Court has said on many occasions that Congress has undoubted constitutional power to prescribe a criminal code applicable to Indian country. So how can this be a jurisdictional element?
So the first thing I'd say is that when Congress passes statutes under the Commerce Clause, it does sometimes create a narrower or higher requirement for the government to meet in terms of what the jurisdictional element is than the baseline constitutional requirement. And the Supreme Court has said in looking at some of those statutes that we can resolve a question of statutory interpretation in terms of what Congress did when we think about this element that does not touch on the constitutional question. But I think the more important point is really that when we're talking about jurisdiction in Indian country.
What kind of jurisdiction?
Criminal.
No, subject matter jurisdiction or some other kind of jurisdiction.
When we're talking about the Congress's choice to prescribe criminal conduct in Indian country. I think that's the language that is frequently used in these cases. We assume that sovereignty is retained unless Congress speaks clearly otherwise. And so there's a presumption that unless Congress says explicitly, we are criminalizing this conduct you know, because it's in Indian country, we don't assume that that's what Congress is doing. And there are cases very recently, as recently as Castro Huerta, the Supreme Court was talking about how 1152 is different than general enclave jurisdiction. So if you eliminate the status requirement, you have a statute that effectively extends, is the same as federal enclave jurisdiction for jurisdictional purposes. And we know that's not what 1152 is. We know that Congress imposed this limitation, and I think that the canons of statutory interpretation that specifically inform the analysis when we're talking about Indian country tell us that unless it's clear that they've reached in this way, we can't assume that they have. And so the fact that we're here and there's this much argument about it, I think suggests that it's not clear. It's far from clear. And when you have an unclear statute in Indian country, we construe it in favor of sovereignty. And criminal jurisprudence is where sovereignty interests are kind of at their zenith.
Can you expand a little bit on Judge Matheson's question? And I want to talk about Louis, the Supreme Court case, Louis in particular. And didn't the court in that case hold that even the land status element in 1152 doesn't implicate subject matter jurisdiction? It's simply an element of the offense. And if that's the case, if the land status element can't implicate subject matter jurisdiction, how could the carve-out proviso, the intra-Indian proviso, create subject matter jurisdiction?
So I don't think that it necessarily creates subject matter jurisdiction.
That's what we're here to talk about, though. I mean, isn't that...
Well, I think
it's
legislative jurisdiction. It's an element of the offense that relates to jurisdiction because Indian country is so nebulous in terms of what the power is. We know there's plenary power. We know that Congress can do a lot, but that's not unbounded. And so it's really exceptionally important that the court look to the exact terms of how Congress has defined its offenses. And so the thing that makes this different and the fact that Congress from the beginning has said we are only touching cases that have diversity of status is something that we need to pay attention to. So Louis, I see that as saying that, yes, the land status is important. And I think that diversity of status is the same. It should be treated the same way. Under the plain terms of the statute.
Okay, so your argument really focuses on this legislative jurisdiction piece. You're not talking about subject matter jurisdiction in terms of the power of the court to act, right?
The power of Congress, yes.
No? Right. Okay, right. You're talking about the power of Congress, not the power of the court, the authority of the court to act. That's not what you're talking about, right?
Right.
Okay.
You
look quizzical, but I mean, the reality is I wasn't clear that that's what your argument was. Your argument is focused on the legislative jurisdiction of Congress to act, right?
Right.
Okay.
There are serious problems, in my view. There are, that are brought up by getting into the question of what Congress can do, and that's where the canon of constitutional avoidance, I think, comes in. But I don't think that we need to reach that question because of what the text of the statute says and because of the interpretive principles that say we interpret statutes in favor of sovereignty.
Well, can we talk about the text of the statute? I'm sorry, Chief. Go ahead.
No, please.
Your way into the argument seems to be to discuss a lot of very important first principles about Indian country offenses. But what about the text of 1152 itself and McKelvey? And, you know, I'd like to know how, in light of the principle for interpreting the plain text of the statute, we can find in favor of your position that the non-Indian status of the defendant is an element, a jurisdictional element.
Yes. The first thing I would say is that I think in this case, even if this court thinks that McKelvey can apply to a statute that, or to an element that is jurisdictional or touches on jurisdiction, It applies when Congress hasn't spoken clearly. It's a default rule. And in Indian country, and when we're talking about Congress's exercise of jurisdiction in Indian country, the first thing that we the first rule is that unless Congress speaks clearly, we don't assume jurisdiction has been expanded. And so if Congress hasn't spoken clearly, I don't think McKelvey can apply. I think the Indian canon applies first. And all of that is really reflected in the structure of the statute and the other textual arguments I make in the briefing for why McKelvey doesn't apply. I see him past 15, so I'd like to pass things over to Mr. Hebert's counsel. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'd like to begin by answering Judge Bacharach's question about Professor Washburn's brief and also Judge Rossman's question about 1153, and that may dovetail to Judge Moritz's question about Louis. 1153 does have a role to play in this case, but it's because of Judge Rossman's opinion in Hobson. Hobson serves as a blueprint. And Judge Bacharach, to your question, why can't we just say it doesn't matter in these kinds of cases? The defendant's status becomes irrelevant because 1153 only grants jurisdiction if the government affirmatively proves the defendant is an Indian, whereas 1152 gives us a gap on both ends.
Well, let me play devil's advocate. The Congress has an enumerated power that would allow a Congress to create a federal crime, whether the defendant is an Indian or not, as long as the crime takes place in Indian country. We know that because the Supreme Court has specifically upheld the constitutionality of the Major Crimes Act. So the jurisdictional element is the fact that the crime takes place in Indian country and that the victim is an Indian. Beyond that, there is no jurisdictional issue restricting Congress's authority to legislate a crime, right?
I agree. This does not implicate Congress's authority to legislate. And Congress has plenary authority.
And we have lots of instances. If you look at 924C1A, the use of a firearm during and in relation to a crime of violence, where we incorporate, Congress has incorporated other crimes, say the Hobbs Act, state burglary statutes that would apply in federal enclaves. You look at 2241, aggravated sexual abuse, that incorporates 2246 definition of sexual act. We have a number of instances where Congress has created a single crime, aggravated sexual abuse, use of a firearm during and in relation to a crime of violence, that spans two separate sections. So why is the fact that Congress delineated this single crime in two separate sections, why does that even matter?
It matters because Congress has chosen to treat Indian tribal sovereignty with great care. And I'll kind of back up a little bit. Section 3231 is the spring from which federal subject matter jurisdiction flows. But that doesn't mean other statutes can't influence the flow of those waters. We know that because Hobson says as much. Hobson demonstrates that subject matter jurisdiction can be circumscribed or perhaps not fully granted in Indian country cases based on how Congress chooses to frame the statutes. We know, for example, that there is no subject matter jurisdiction for non-Indian on non-Indian offenses simply because they occur in Indian country. McBratney completely throws out that possibility. Arguably, Congress couldn't even legislate that because it doesn't involve Indian affairs. Could Congress make a statute that takes the Major Crimes Act and expands it across the board? All Indian on Indian offenses, no matter how minor, could...
Well, yeah, and that... Maybe
yes.
Not, but I don't. That's not what I'm wondering about. I mean, 1153 doesn't include every crime.
Correct.
It includes a lot of crimes. Yeah. But my question is just far simpler than that, and that is, why isn't the crime, just like Judge Higginson said in his Fifth Circuit opinion, there he was talking about the malicious abuse of property, but here we're talking about killing somebody. Why isn't the crime killing somebody? And the jurisdictional, what your colleagues point about legislative authority, why isn't that satisfied with the fact that the killing somebody takes place on in Indian country against an Indian? So we have legislative authority, your colleagues' concern satisfied, 3231, of course, we do have, the district court does have subject matter jurisdiction. So why isn't the crime, regardless of Congress's care in articulating crimes in Indian country, why didn't Congress do that, the combination of 1152 and 1153?
The answer to that, Your Honor, goes to how we prove subject matter jurisdiction and where the burden rests. Okay. Because it is my position that this is a subject matter jurisdiction question. This does go to the court's adjudicative authority. So the burden to prove that subject matter jurisdiction exists always rests with the party that is asserting that jurisdiction exists. When subject matter jurisdiction is asserted under 1153, the government now bears the affirmative burden of proving the defendant is an Indian. And so the Major Crimes Act, the fact that, you know, this offense, Mr. Hebert's offense, Mr. Ruiz's offense, would fall under 1153, that's true, but the government would then bear the affirmative obligation to prove he is an Indian. Otherwise, it's simply not an offense against the laws of the United States, because 1153 creates that limitation. 1152 creates a similar limitation. 1152 says the general laws of the United States that apply to special territorial jurisdiction shall apply to the Indian country or shall extend to the Indian country. It immediately follows by saying that that section shall not extend to offenses committed by one Indian against the person or property of another Indian. In other words, Congress has said, if you're bringing 1152, you better prove that they have diverse statuses or it's just not an offense against the laws of the United States. And if it's not an offense against the laws of the United States, there is no subject matter jurisdiction.
But doesn't that assume that Indian status is an element?
I don't think it has to, Your Honor. When we use the word element, we can also set, much like jurisdiction, the word element can mean many things. Element, as we typically think of it, goes to the facts that must be true as far as the substantive offense is concerned. It is not necessary to prove a substantive offense that the defendant and victim have diverse statuses, but it is a necessary prerequisite to the court's entry of judgment in the case because it goes to the court's subject matter jurisdiction.
Let me ask this in a different way. Your colleague focused primarily on legislative jurisdiction. Your brief and your argument focuses more on subject matter jurisdiction. Are you saying we should overturn the holding in Prentice that 1152 doesn't concern subject matter jurisdiction?
Prentice's discussion of subject matter jurisdiction is brief, to say the least. Prentice's concern with the idea of jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction went to the more specific concern, or a more general concern, depending on how one thinks of it, that the absence of an element of the crime from an indictment would strip the court of subject matter jurisdiction. And that is simply not the case. The absence of an element does not strip the court of subject matter jurisdiction. We know that from Cotton and subsequent cases from the Supreme Court. That doesn't mean, however, that Prentice never actually considered the idea of whether this specific issue was specifically about subject matter jurisdiction under 3231. That question was never really before the Prentice court. It was only asking if an element is missing, has the court been deprived of jurisdiction? It answered no, and it was correct in that sense.
And isn't that the issue you're talking about? I mean, I'm struggling to follow what's going on here as it relates to your argument. Are you saying that we are talking about a court's power to act, or are you talking about whether, if that element is not present, the case has not been the element, if the Indian status is not satisfied, that then there has not been a valid prosecution? Which are you talking about?
The subject matter of the subject matter jurisdiction of the court can be properly invoked at the opening stages through an indictment and its allegations.
Subject matter jurisdiction, yes. Is what? Is it 3231? Is that
yes, Your Honor?
Okay, so Full stop. 3231. You walk into the court. There's an indictment. You can decide whether the court has the power to act. Is it a federal offense, right?
Only if there 1152 creates a few barriers to that. One, 1152 says it is not, the laws of the United States don't apply to Indian on Indian offenses. If the laws of the United States do not apply, then there can be no offense against the United States and therefore no subject matter jurisdiction.
There cannot be a valid prosecution, but to go to Judge Matheson's point, why didn't Prentice deal with that exact question and say, no, 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 we're not talking about the court's power to act. 3231, what we're talking about is whether there's a valid prosecution.
Prentice was concerned with any element missing from an indictment. And to use the gun example that Judge Matheson was talking about, the failure to allege that the firearm moved in interstate commerce would be an equal scenario. Prentice essentially said that element being missing would not deprive the court of subject matter jurisdiction.
Okay, it's treated an equal scenario. Well, if it's an equal scenario, why doesn't that same scenario here equal no lack of subject matter jurisdiction?
Prentice treated Indian status as a substantive element of the offense itself rather than a component of the court's subject matter jurisdiction.
Okay, if it's a substantive element of the offense, just like in any case where the government fails to satisfy the substantive elements of the offense, the court doesn't lose jurisdiction. The government just loses, right?
In those cases, yes.
Okay, why isn't that like this case in some sense, in the sense that the government just loses? There's no jurisdictional aspect to this. Why is there a jurisdictional aspect to this?
There's a jurisdictional aspect to it because of the way 1152 is structured. To say that the general laws of the United States apply, but then just immediately turn around and say, no, they don't apply when it's an Indian on Indian offense. And in that sense, there's no offense against the laws of the United States. The opening salvo, the indictment, might give rise to the court's subject matter jurisdiction, but just like in civil cases, subject matter jurisdiction can be destroyed. And when a defendant pleads not guilty to an indictment, they have denied all allegations contained within the indictment. The government then bears the burden to prove the allegation that provides subject matter jurisdiction, the diverse statuses.
So you're saying Congress gave and Congress took away? In the first paragraph it gave, and the second paragraph it took away.
That is precisely what I'm saying, Your
okay.
Honor.
Okay. What do we do with all of the Supreme Court cases saying, talking about how we deal with the question of jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction, and how we should not lightly determine that somehow or other the court is deprived of subject matter jurisdiction? What do we do with those cases?
I think Bryant is the best case for that, Your Honor. And I know Bryant is not itself about jurisdiction, but it says something very important. Congress has long excluded from federal court jurisdiction crimes committed by one Indian against the person or property of another Indian. And it explicitly cites 1152 and the Supreme Court's earlier decision in Crow Dog for that premise. I see I have 1 minute left. I would like to reserve that remaining minute for rebuttal, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, and may it please the court, counsel. I'm Paige Messick for the United States, and with me at council table is Linda Epperly. The court has the opportunity today to correct a misstep taken 25 years ago, one that now threatens to deprive the child victims of Dennis Hebert and Joel Ruiz's crimes of the verdict that their juries delivered. When a defendant is charged under Section 1152 with a crime against an Indian victim, the defendant's status as an Indian is an affirmative defense that he bears the entire burden of presenting, as opposed to his non-Indian status being an element that the government must prove.
When you say the entire burden, you're saying both the burden of production and the burden of persuasion?
Yes, Your Honor.
Persuasion is on the defendant.
That's right. That's right. And I realize that
that would be
if
contrary to every case that's considered it, right?
You are right. You are right. And I know that if we are getting to the point of burden of persuasion, the court has already found that the burden of production rests with the defendant. And in that case, I'm truly not trying to look a gift horse in the mouth. I know that this is more than any court has given us so far, but we really think that the law requires you to take that extra step. The Supreme Court has given a lot of guidance on the burden of persuasion in the last couple of decades, first in Dixon, then in Smith. And it is now clear that when we have an affirmative defense in the proviso of a statute, on which Congress has not expressed how the allocation of the burden of persuasion should go, the court is to assume that Congress intended the common law rule under which the defendant bore both the burden of production and the burden of persuasion.
And in the circuits that that are counter to your position on the burden of persuasion, did those come before or after Dixon?
The Ninth Circuit came before, and the Fifth Circuit came after.
And did either of those decisions, in your view, give us guidance on this question? Or, I mean, Hester certainly didn't. Does Hagerty?
Not a lot, I would say, Your Honor. I believe Hagerty, although it came after Dixon and Smith, I think Hagerty was essentially boxed into its position on burden of persuasion by its reading of Famous Smith, which we believe was incorrect. And so if you read Famous Smith the way that the Fifth Circuit did, then you have to say that the government carries a burden of persuasion. But the Fifth Circuit's short explanation for why that burden should rest with the government, it just doesn't hold up. So the Fifth Circuit cites the Supreme Court for jurisdictional elements and Torres v. Lynch on jurisdictional elements and says, well, this effectively narrows the scope of a jurisdictional situs element, so it has to be an affirmative defense. But it doesn't narrow the scope of the jurisdictional situs element. That element is the occurrence of the crime in Indian country, and the fact that it's committed by one Indian against another Indian doesn't have any narrowing of that jurisdictional situs element. And then Hester, of course, relied upon a case, Guess, which did predate both Dixon and Smith, I mean, as Hester did itself.
I didn't mean to interrupt you. Could you go ahead?
No, not at all.
Sorry about that. Let me play devil's advocate. Hagerty didn't just rely on Famous Smith, it also relied on Lucas versus United States. And there is an argument that you make about the two sentences in Famous Smith, but I didn't read anything that the government has said about Lucas versus United States. And tell me if I'm wrong, but I think Lucas versus United States is pretty unequivocal. And I think even Judge Higginson acknowledges it. As far as the burden of persuasion, the Supreme Court said that the government bears the burden of proving by competent evidence the victim's status as a jurisdictional element, right?
Yes, that is in Lucas.
All right, and that's the Supreme Court, so we can't overrule Lucas, even though it's old, right? And so if one of those three exceptions under your McKelvey argument refers to the victim's status, we know that under Lucas that the Supreme Court has said, well, the government bears the burden of persuasion on the jurisdictional requirement of the victim's status. So to take Ms. Edelman's rhetorical question, and let me pose it to you. So if one of the three exceptions implicates the government's burden of persuasion under Lucas, then what is the basis for saying that the Indian-on-Indian exception is treated any different in terms of the burden of persuasion than the victim's status, which we know the government bears the burden?
So, Your Honor, we would respectfully disagree that Lucas binds this court to find that government bears the burden of persuasion on victim status. Lucas was not interpreting 1152 or 1152's predecessor. It was explicitly interpreting the act of May 2nd, 1890. And in addition, Lucas...
Why does that matter if we're talking about victim status being a jurisdictional element?
Because that act has different language than 1152. And so in addition to not being an 1152 case, the question of burden was not at issue in Lucas. In Lucas, the government had alleged the victim status, had proven it never and never disputed that it that that was an element, essentially, or that it never disputed that that was its burden. And so the question of burden was just not before the court in Lucas. So for those two reasons, we think that Lucas just offers very little of relevance to the present question.
Thank you.
Counsel, could I just shift gears? This may sound a little bit like another question about the amicus brief, but it's not exactly the same thing. So in cases like this one, why isn't the solution for the government to indict in the alternative under 1152 and 1153, as it did in actually a recent case, the United States versus King case that was issued recently? I mean, why isn't that right. The answer? And then we wouldn't have to be overturning an en banc decision.
Well, I understand that King said the government could do that. But I think it is a tricky situation for the government to do that because we have to go to the grand jury and ask them to find, under the court's current case law, both probable cause that the defendant is an Indian and probable cause that the defendant is not an Indian. And I know that probable cause is a standard beneath preponderance of the evidence. So it is conceivable that the government could go honestly and do that, but that is definitely not going to be every case. And so, in fact, I think it's probably a rare case in which those probabilities line up to allow the government to say both. And so I don't think that we can just fix this by essentially indicting in the alternative.
I was somewhat struck by your argument about what happens if we rule in your favor. I don't understand what the basis would be for us to go back and essentially have some sort of summary judgment proceeding over whether, in fact, they can satisfy their burden as you allocated regarding whether they're non-Indian or not. I mean, what basis is there to do that? And when you think about the fact that we're in a criminal context in which ordinarily, if there's ever going to be a situation where things have to be litigated in a trial context, it's going to be that context. So what basis is there for such a proceeding and a truncated proceeding at that?
Are you asking, Your Honor, what basis is there for not just automatically ordering retrials? Or are you asking
exactly what I'm asking. Why not we go, if you were to prevail, why not, as we've done in many, many other contexts, proceeding to follow would be a retrial as opposed to this briefing process, which I thought you were alluding to in your brief.
So if there is to be a new trial or new trials for the defendant, they would be on the basis of essentially trial error, that the first trials were conducted under a legal standard that was incorrect, and that the defendants were prejudiced in some way by the conduct of the trials under that standard. And if they were raising this on appeal right now, if Prentice had already been overturned and a district court missed that, the defendants would have to show this court some kind of prejudice that they have suffered from that. Not simply, well, we might have done it differently. Because although the government did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that these men are not Indian, it seems highly likely that they are not Indian. Neither has offered ever any proof to suggest that he is. And so we would say you shouldn't order new trials on the basis of trial error that may be entirely harmless.
Hit the pause button. Why would they have had any reason to introduce any proof that they were non-Indians if under a legal regime in which the burden was with the government to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt? What burden? They didn't have to do anything.
Of course, we understand that. And that's why we haven't just said if the burden is theirs, then they lose and you should affirm the convictions. We understand that the defendant, under the Prentice framework, wouldn't have had a clear incentive. There's always some incentive to present evidence in your favor if you think you have it, even if the government bears the burden. But we can understand that there might have been countervailing considerations
Like the Fifth Amendment, right?
well, let's
Mr.
talk
Heber
about
Mr. stands up and says, I defend. I am an Indian. And the government says, okay, we'll dismiss with prejudice. next day indicted under 1153. He's just confessed to an element.
You know, I think it is a complicated question whether the government could do that, just turn around and indict. I think the Blockberger test and the application to cases with affirmative defenses is far from clear. And so, but let's say that a defendant at least would have that concern, right? And so we understand that a defendant might conduct this trial differently if not under the Prentice standard. And that's why we haven't just said affirm these convictions. They haven't shown any prejudice. We think they should have an opportunity to show that they have been prejudiced.
Why aren't you prevented under double jeopardy from retrying these defendants? In both cases, there was a determination that the evidence was insufficient on non-Indian status.
The determination was by the panel decisions, which have now been vacated by the en banc court. And that's very similar
in posture.
But we
have cases, you know, Smith versus Massachusetts. We have Fong Fu versus United States. I mean, the Supreme Court seems to say if you have a determination that there's insufficient evidence, the fact that the court changes its mind at a different level doesn't necessarily change the fact that you had a determination of insufficient evidence for purposes of the Fifth Amendment.
I think the distinction here is let's put this in the context of a district court. After a verdict of guilty issues a judgment of acquittal, that is reviewable by this court on appeal. And if this court disagrees with the district court's verdict or a judgment of acquittal, the guilty verdict can be reinstated without additional proceedings. That's essentially what would happen here if this en banc court is basically reviewing the panel's decisions that the evidence was insufficient. If you think that the panels employed the wrong rule of law, you can simply reinstate the guilty verdicts, which haven't, in fact, been vacated yet. But if they had, you could just reinstate the guilty verdicts. Any new trials that are subsequently held are not held because the government introduced insufficient evidence, but because there was trial error in conducting the first trials under the Prentice framework.
Well, at least one of the panel decisions actually instructed that the guilty verdict be vacated.
But those panel decisions, but the mandates never issued. The court accepted the cases for rehearing en banc. But even if this court, for instance, en banc reached the same conclusion and it went up to the Supreme Court, if the Supreme Court said, no, you apply the wrong rule, it would not offend double jeopardy to reinstate the guilty verdicts, because any new trials are not because of insufficient evidence. They're for trial error, and that's fine under Burks. We don't need to have a new trial because of insufficiency of the evidence. That's what would be the problem, right? If the insufficiency determinations stand, obviously, we cannot go back to district court and subject the defendants to a new trial. But we are not conceding that new trials are necessary here. We think that the court should remand to the district court so that it can conduct a determination of whether new trials should be ordered based on trial error, essentially as if the defendants had argued on appeal that that conducting the proceedings under Prentice was a form of trial error that made their convictions unfair.
Well, wasn't that ex post facto?
There's no ex post facto problem here because this is not a novel construction of the statute that has been previously undisclosed by the language of the statute or by any prior judicial decision. That's the ex post facto due process standard. And here, when a court moves from one side of a circuit split to another, under Supreme Court precedent, under Rogers, that's not a due process ex post facto problem.
But the entire case proceeded with the belief that Prentice applied. Everybody assumed it did. And that was, at the time, the correct state of the law. Why isn't there a due process violation? Why? I don't think I understand your novel approach. It certainly was our case law, this circuit's binding case law at the time. And that's how the case was tried.
Yes,
so now we're going to retroactively apply our new case law?
So the court So there's no need to retroactively apply the new case law if there are no new trials. So that would depend on a showing of prejudice. But let's say that there are new trials. It does not offend the ex post facto influence due process clause. It does not violate that clause to have the defendants stand trial on the new standard, because the new standard was not essentially unpredictable or totally unjustified based on the law.
How could they have predicted that? I mean, that was our case law. How could they have predicted during trial that we would reverse ourselves?
I think
if we do,
it's very unlikely.
Is there a case to support what you're saying?
Yes, it's Rogers in the Supreme Court.
And what were the facts of that case?
I don't recall the facts of Rogers, but I know that in that case, the Supreme Court moved from the defendant. So the defendant had come from a circuit that employed one rule, and the Supreme Court went with the other side of the circuit split and said it does not violate the
It was the year and a day rule for the death of the victim.
Yes, yes, that's right.
And what the court said was that Tennessee had never actually applied the year and a day rule that they then changed. But here we've been applying it for 25 years.
Mm-hmm. That's right. But there are two other circuits out there that have taken the opposite view. And there is no ex post facto problem unless the new interpretation was never previously disclosed by any judicial decision, right? That's a direct quotation of the standard. We have two judicial decisions out there that, and some concurrences and dissents that have previously disclosed that interpretation.
Direct quote beyond, from where?
From the...
Not from Rogers.
No, not from Rogers. That's from the ex post... See, I think it's Lanier, which is then turned quoting a Supreme Court case on the ex post facto standard. The due process bars novel construction of a criminal statute to conduct that neither the statute nor any prior judicial decision has fairly disclosed to be within its scope.
And what are you quoting?
Lanier. But I believe Ed Lanier is a Supreme Court case. It may be quoting a previous case also. And so not only do we have previous judicial decisions that have adopted the interpretation of the statute that we are proposing today, but we have the language and the structure of the statute itself. So when you look at the statute and you apply the longstanding proviso doctrine to that statute, you see that these are affirmative defenses, and that is something that is knowable to a person without this court having previously reached that. So the statute itself gives that answer, and other courts have already reached that answer, as well as dissents of this own court. So a defendant knows that there is at least a chance that this court or the Supreme Court will take the opposite view. The boundaries of this dispute have been well defined before either of these defendants committed their crimes.
Would the Indian law canon apply in these circumstances?
The Indian law canon supports the government's reading here. And the defendants take an extremely constricted view of tribal interests here, essentially confining tribal interests to only sovereignty. That's not how the canon works. It has always taken a more broad view of tribal interests. And if you look at the tribe's interest in protecting its Indian victims, in promoting safety on the reservations, those interests are better advanced by the government's interpretation. But if you only look at sovereignty, that is still not a problem for the government's interpretation here, because the government's interpretation does not harm tribal sovereignty in any manner.
And one of the other issues here was the defendant really held the cards in on his status, and I think some of the briefs suggest that that's a bit of a red herring. It's, you know, in our cases we've reversed convictions because of inadequate evidence, but maybe that's because the government just didn't try hard enough and find the right witnesses. Is it a burden on the prosecutors to prove Indian status in these cases?
No, it's not it's not a burden on the prosecution to prove. It's an affirmative defense for the defendant to raise.
I understood the question to be, is it onerous?
Is it an onerous burden?
Yes.
Under the Prentice regime.
Oh, it is. It is an onerous burden. The Supreme Court has referred to the burden of proving a negative on which the defendant has an informational asymmetrical advantage, something like that. That was Smith, to be nearly impossible. Now, of course, we prove the defendant's non-Indian status regularly in these cases, but there are some cases where it's really very difficult to do. And the question, I don't believe, should be whether the government ever stumbles in carrying a very heavy burden that Congress never meant to assign to us in the first place. It's easy. It's easy to trip up when you're trying to do something
The defendants here make a pretty good argument that in both cases, the government really didn't make much of a valiant effort to meet its burden. And I mean, their brief's pretty persuasive on that.
I will say, of course, sometimes there are always more questions you could ask another witness to find, right? We're not saying that we have never made mistakes in these cases. That's not our position. And we're not asking the en banc court to find that the panels were wrong in finding that there was insufficient evidence here. We're asking the en banc court to find that this is not our burden in the first place. Congress never intended it to be our burden in the first place.
Where in the framework of, if we're thinking about whether or not something's an affirmative defense, what is the law that compels us to be interested in this data point about how hard it is for the government to prove non-Indian status?
Your Honor, we haven't actually argued, as a matter of statutory interpretation, that the court has to consider how hard the government's burden is. I think we have argued in our petition for rehearing that the difficulty of carrying that burden makes this an issue of exceptional importance, because if the Prentice standard were easy to meet, then it really wouldn't matter whether Prentice was right or wrong. We haven't said that there is a hard and fast rule of statutory interpretation that means you have to assign the burden to the party that can most easily carry it. But that is something that the Supreme Court has looked at and that this court has looked at, right? In the case about the wilderness area, UNSER. In UNSER, this court said that was a pragmatic element that it could properly consider. And in Smith, a unanimous Supreme Court looked at whether the government was being asked to carry a burden that the defendant had the best evidence of, and also noted that in that case, it would have been a burden that would require it to prove a negative. So these are legitimate concerns. They are just one factor, but they are a relevant factor that the courts have looked to.
Those sort of work. Oh, go ahead.
Who was that?
It was me, but go ahead.
Judge Bachrach. Go ahead, Judge Bachrach.
No, okay, sorry.
You go ahead.
Sorry, Joel.
I forgot my question. It's my turn?
Okay. I thought he was going to go ahead.
I passed.
Seniority. I guess he gets to decide that I go first. All right. So, our discussion on who has the best information as part of this calculus. I mean, part of your position is that the victim status belongs to the defendant as well. And that seems to be work against you in that regard, because that seems to be something that would be more in your knowledge, because the victim's generally on your team. So how do you reconcile those two things?
I don't know that anyone has the special advantage when it comes to a victim status. Sometimes victims are cooperative with the government, sometimes they aren't. The government doesn't have any special insight that a defendant can't access as to a victim status. We haven't argued, of course, that this is something that the defendant has special knowledge of. There may be cases where the defendant has special knowledge of the victim status because they are closely related or know each other well, for instance. But we're not arguing that piece is supported by the peculiar knowledge rule. But having the defendant have to prove the victim's Indian status as an affirmative defense is different from what the government has to do in the Prentice situation in several important ways. First, the defendant would only be making that showing by a preponderance. It is not proving a negative. It is proving a positive. And a victim can be subpoenaed to testify about their Indian status in a way that a criminal defendant can never be.
Can you point to any other area in federal criminal law where the defendant has the obligation to offer an affirmative showing of proof about a victim?
I can't think of anything else. This 1152 is a pretty unusual statute on its own. I don't think that there is a perfect analogy out there. But Congress certainly has the authority to put an affirmative defense on a defendant, even if the defendant doesn't have the special access to those facts. And Congress, by employing the longstanding proviso rule, has done so here.
Are we talking about victim status at all in this case?
The court doesn't have to resolve victim status, right? The Fifth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit have not done that. They have only said that the defendant's Indian status is an affirmative defense in a case with an Indian victim. But we have not tried to hide the fact that a logical extension of our proviso argument would encompass probably both sides of the status question and the other exceptions in 1152's second paragraph.
Well, part of the argument did go to the special knowledge that the defendant would have as to his status. And obviously, that's not necessarily going to be the case as it relates to the victim. So are you telling me we need to consider and decide both? Because I certainly wouldn't focus on that as being what we had at issue here.
No. We are not saying that you need to decide broadly anything about proving victim status.
Well, just to be clear on this point, the appellants say that because the burden on the victim's Indian status is on the government, that's how they read the law, the two have to go together. That is, the burden on the defendant's Indian status, therefore, also must be on the government. So that's how the issues get tied together. That's at least their argument. What is your direct response to that?
Our response, I believe that argument of theirs is based on Smith. And we think that that's the wrong reading of Smith.
The 1894 Smith.
The 1894 Smith. There are a lot of Smiths in this case, but yes, famous Smith. So we believe that argument is wrong because famous Smith did not address a question of burden. And so we don't have, in that case, a data point that says the Supreme Court has said the victim status belongs as a government burden. Famous Smith decided one question, and that was not a question of burden. It said in its very first sentence, this case, so far as we have found it necessary to consider it, raises one question, and then it goes on to say that the question, I'm sorry, I see that I am out of time.
Please finish.
May I finish? Says that the question in that case is whether the undisputed evidence showed the defendant or showed the victim to be an Indian. It was not identifying the question of burden as the only question, even though the government had argued to the Supreme Court, you have to decide this before you can resolve this case. The Supreme Court declined to do so and, in fact, has spent a lot of effort in that case to show that the evidence was so one-sided that the defendant was entitled to a directed verdict. Whereas if it had already decided that that was a government burden beyond a reasonable doubt, all it had to do was say this one piece of evidence the government has introduced is not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So we think that that is not the right reading of Smith, and Smith does not constrain this court to conclude anything about victim status.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Would you give them 2 minutes, please?
Thank you, Chief Judge Holmes. I want to very quickly address one point that's been made and then turn to the retrial issue. As to the proviso and the notion that either it's an affirmative defense, is the victim status on the government or the defendant, if the statute is interpreted by its plain language to create an affirmative defense, that the defendant bears the burden to prove, then the entire proviso goes to the defendant. It cannot be split. There is no basis within the plain language to split the burdens between the defendant and the government, which is precisely why the entire burden rests with the government. There is no basis for saying it. It's an affirmative defense because it is irrational and illogical to think that Congress intended for the defendant to bear the burden of proving a victim's status. And now I'd like to quickly turn to retrial.
Mr. Gummer, I know you want to get to retrial, and I want to hear what you have to say, but after listening to you and Ms. Edelman, you emphasized subject matter jurisdiction. She emphasized legislative jurisdiction. Are you two on the same page, or is there some tension in your respective positions?
I have adopted counsel's arguments as an alternative position, but I have taken the approach of addressing subject matter jurisdiction because I believed in an argument that deviated from simply defending Prentiss was appropriate. And so while I've adopted Ms. Edelman's arguments as my own as well, I understand there could be some tension that we cannot both be right. So as to the retrial issue, the government, as I understood their argument, has explicitly abandoned the premise that the verdict can simply be reinstated. And in their opening brief, I see I'm almost out of time.
Go ahead. Finish the thought.
Thank you, Your Honor. In its opening brief, the government admits it was reasonable for the defendants to rely upon Prentiss in conducting their trials, which then goes back to the question of judicial retroactivity. If it was entirely reasonable for the defendants to conduct their trials in reliance on Prentiss, then judicial retroactivity simply can't apply.
What about Rogers? Can you address over here? Can you address Rogers, which she cited for the idea that if this isn't a novel concept, then there's no due process or judicial retroactivity issue?
Rogers does not solve this problem, Your Honor, because this is a very unique situation. As Your Honor alluded to during the government's argument, this was an en banc decision of this court that stood for 25 years. It was entirely unpredictable that this court would then choose to go en banc a second time and do what, frankly, I'm not sure has ever been done in the history of the country, which is an en banc court reverse another en banc court's decision.
What if the Supreme Court reversed Prentiss? Would that be a due process problem?
The Supreme Court would get the opportunity to resolve that itself, Your Honor. And then it would get to resolve whether it thought Rogers addressed the issue. But I think the fact that we are dealing with an en banc decision being reversed by a later en banc court takes it out of the realm of Rogers and into its own category.
Are you saying Rogers really doesn't, I mean, the idea of this being a novel concept doesn't really apply in this situation? I mean, you said it was not predictable. I agree with that. But it's not really novel either when you've got several other circuits, or two at least, going that direction, and plenty of good arguments to be made that Prentiss is incorrect.
There are arguments to be made that Prentiss is incorrect. I can acknowledge that, Your Honor. There are arguments to be made that Prentiss is correct. And this court's decision, it's not cited in my brief. The government addressed retroactivity for the first time in its reply. But Butter, United States versus Butter, 76 F4th 1007, is actually heavily about judicial retroactivity. And one of the things that it considers is the touchstone is whether the statute, either standing alone as construed, either standing alone or as construed, made it reasonably clear at the relevant time that the defendant's conduct was criminal. The statute is, at best, ambiguous. And on top of that, Butter discusses the idea of unforeseeable judicial decisions not permitting judicial retroactivity. And there's a final point to be made. There is nothing about judicial retroactivity that allows a retrial. There is nothing about judicial retroactivity that allows a retrial. Judicial retroactivity is about applying the law to the trial as it happened. Mm-hmm. A retrial is still a double jeopardy violation, Your Honor, and there is no opportunity for a retrial. The government doesn't get a second bite at the apple. There are no equities balanced.
The purpose of the retrial would be that it's unfair to the defendant, in this case, to be held to a burden of production that would not have been anticipated. So the reason for the retrial at all has nothing to do with our ultimate decision that there's sufficient evidence of guilt. It's that it's not fair to the defendant to affirm the conviction when the defendant had no opportunity to produce something. And my understanding of the government's argument is that, well, we shouldn't have to have a retrial if the defendant can't show that he was prejudiced by not being able to, by thinking he had, you know what I mean. And so that's the reason for the retrial, is because the defendant would not have anticipated a need to make, to produce evidence of his non-Indian status.
If I may ask a question, Your Honor, what is the ruling on sufficiency of the evidence in that scenario? Because the court has to rule on that one way or the other. If the evidence is ruled sufficient, then judicial retroactivity is...
If Prentice is reversed, then there's no problem. The government satisfied its burden. And we don't worry about the affirmative defense that wasn't raised by the defendant. So we would be saying the verdict stands. There was no error in that verdict in terms of sufficiency of the evidence. But it's unfair to hold the defendant to that when the defendant thought that he didn't have to put on any evidence of non-Indian status. So there's a possibility of a retrial, but not if defendant can't show that it was prejudicial. In other words, the defendant would have to show, I could have put on some evidence of non-Indian status. That's the government's position, as I understand it.
I think that is the government's position, Your Honor. The problem is I'm not sure there's a procedural basis for that. In order to hold that the evidence was sufficient, this court would have to apply judicial retroactivity to the trials as it happened, which would violate due process.
What would be retroactive? There clearly was sufficient evidence of guilt. The jury found that. We have said that the elements of the crime were all proved. The reason the panel reversed was our precedent saying, well, the government needed to prove an additional element. Now we'd be saying it wasn't necessary to prove that additional element, so there was sufficient evidence of guilt. We can affirm the conviction on the ground of sufficient evidence. But then you say, and I think it's a good argument for the defendant, that would be unfair because we had no opportunity. We didn't know we were supposed to put on to produce evidence of this defense. And so maybe we need to retrial. But first, we need to say if there's any prejudice to the defendant. So you would need to put on some evidence, present some evidence that you could have presented this defense. And if not, there's no need for a retrial. If you can, then it needs to be retried. I don't see any procedural problem with that.
As to the end point there, Your Honor, the notion that the defendant has to go through some sort of quasi-summary judgment proceeding to put on evidence, I'm not sure there's any...
It's not summary judgment. Just give us some evidence. Any evidence will do. Okay.
Any evidence by which a jury could find in the defendant's favor, it looks an awful lot like summary judgment in that sense.
Well,
So, but there's no procedural basis in criminal law for a process like that. On top of that, Your Honor...
There's no precedent for saying, yes, there was an error, but it was harmless, so there's no remedy?
To say that we send it back so that the defendant can try and prove prejudice and then get a retrial if they can? I'm not aware of such a case, Your Honor. I see. Well, I'm well.
Can I ask one follow-up to Judge Hartz's question? Well, what about self-defense? So if the issue were, let's say that the district court said, defendant, you asserted self-defense too late, so I am not going to allow you to assert self-defense, and a panel said, no, that's a misreading of your local rule or federal rules of criminal procedure, and it sent it back, and then the district court said, well, you are allowed, defendant, to assert self-defense. Well, to take Judge Hartz's questions, well, there certainly would be no problem, would there be, in retrying the defendant and saying, well, government, you do have the burden of persuasion to show beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not act in self-defense, but that's contingent on the defendant at least invoking self-defense, which he or she had been foreclosed from doing. So wouldn't that be an illustration where Judge Hartz's point is right, that there's no reason that he couldn't be retried, and it's not summary judgment, it's just saying, okay, you you have the right to assert that you were an Indian, and now the government has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was not an Indian.
As I understand Your Honor's question, that is assuming we go directly to retrial, not an intermediate proceeding where the defendant tries to present evidence in order to get a retrial. Is that correct?
Well, I'm just, I don't know. I'm just asking you that there's no constitutional impediment, is there, to retrying the defendant? And that's not a double jeopardy violation. It's simply saying, defendant, you have the right to assert that you were an Indian. You have the right to assert self-defense. And now we're going to retry the defendant. And then the government has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that, let's say that he did not act in self-defense or that he's an Indian.
That is correct, Your Honor. A retrial would be available because that goes to an error in the procedural conduct of the trial. The defendant was prevented from presenting evidence that they were entitled to present. In essence, the trial was unfair and they should get another shot at it. When a defendant raises that kind of argument, they implicitly waive their double jeopardy protection. I see I am well over 10 minutes.
You can stop if you want. I thought there was but coming behind that, but if there's no but, then yeah, you can sit down.
I just wanted to acknowledge that, Your Honor. In that scenario, the defendant has essentially waived their right to double jeopardy protections. But when a defendant challenges the sufficiency of the evidence, there is no such waiver. And so that comes back to this problem. What is the ruling on sufficiency of the evidence? If the answer is the evidence was insufficient under the law as it existed at the time the trial was conducted, then there's no retrial period.
Why would that be the issue? The issue is whether, under the present law decided by the en banc court, whether there was sufficient evidence at trial. And if the en banc court says that there was no need to put on this to overcome this affirmative defense, then there was sufficient evidence at the trial. There's no double jeopardy problem.
In that scenario, Your Honor, in order to get there, and I understand what Your Honor is saying, if Your Honor put a gun to my head and said, you can have a retrial, but we're going to change the standard on you, do you accept that, or do you just want your client to be convicted and that ends the case? Of course, I want the retrial. My client wants the retrial in that scenario. My point, though, is that in order to get there, this court first has to rule on the judicial retroactivity issue of the new standard, whether the new standard can be applied to the trial at all.
Yeah, okay.
If it can, then yes, Your Honor is correct. We certainly want a retrial in that scenario in order to...
Yeah, if I reverse Apprentice, if we reverse Apprentice,
and
then we have to decide that it's retroactive to these cases.
Right.
And you're saying if it is retroactive, that's one thing. If it's not retroactive, then there can't be a retrial.
Correct, Your Honor. That is precisely my point. If there are no further questions.
That's been a lot of time. Thank you for your argument. Unless anybody wants to bring Ms. Messick into the party, then we will consider the case submitted. Thank you, counsel.